White, now a full-fledged Californian and raging death penalty abolitionist, begged Ronnie to move to Sacramento, where the living was easy and laid back and the past was truly forgotten. Ron loved the idea, but it was more fun to talk about than to actually pursue. Bruce Leiba found Ron and offered him a room, something he'd done many times in the past. Annette approved, and Ron moved in with Bruce, who at the time was driving a truck. Ron rode shotgun and thoroughly enjoyed the freedom of the open highways. Annette predicted that the arrangement would last no more than 3 months, which was Ron's average. Every routine and every place soon bored him, and 3 months later, he and Bruce argued over something neither could remember. Ron moved back to Tulsa, stayed with Annette for a few weeks, then rented a small hotel suite for 3 months. In 2001, 2 years after the release of Dennis and Ron, and almost 19 years after the murder, the Ada police concluded the investigation. Then 2 more years passed before Glenn Gore was moved from the prison at Lexington and put on trial. For a host of reasons, Bill Peterson did not prosecute the case. Standing before a jury and pointing to the defendant and saying something like, "Glenn Gore, you deserve to die for what you did to Debbie Carter," would have been a hard sell, since he'd pointed at 2 other men and made the same accusation. Peterson begged off on conflict of interest grounds, but sent his assistant, Chris Ross, to sit at the state's table and take notes. A special prosecutor was sent in from Oklahoma City, Richard Wintery, who, armed with the DNA results, got an easy conviction. After hearing the details of Gore's long and violent criminal record, the jury had no trouble recommending the death penalty. Dennis refused to follow the trial, but Ron couldn't ignore it. He called Judge Landreth every day and said, "Tommy, you gotta get Ricky Joe Simmons." "Tommy, forget Gore. Ricky Joe Simmons is the real killer." One nursing home led to another. Once he grew bored with a new place or wore out his welcome, the phone calls would start and Annette would scramble to find another facility willing to care for him. Then she would pack him up and make the move. Some of the homes reeked of disinfectant and looming death, while others were warm and welcoming. He was in a pleasant one in the town of Howe when Dr. Susan Sharp paid him a visit. Ron had been sober for weeks and felt great. They drove to a lakeside park near the town and went for a walk. The day was cloudless, the air cool and crisp. "He was like a little boy," Dr. Sharp said, "happy to be outside in the sun on a beautiful day." When he was sober and medicated, he was a delight to be with. That night they had a date, dinner in a nearby restaurant. Ron was quite proud of himself because he was treating a nice lady to a steak dinner. Chapter 17. The severe stomach pains began in the early fall of 2004. Ron felt bloated and was uncomfortable sitting or lying down. Walking helped some, but the pain was increasing. He was always tired and couldn't sleep. He roamed the halls of his latest nursing home at all hours of the night, trying to find relief from the pressure building around his stomach. Annette was 2 hours away and hadn't seen him in a month, though she had heard his complaints by phone. When she picked him up for a visit to the dentist, she was shocked at the size of his stomach. "He looked 10 months pregnant," she said. They vetoed the dentist and went straight to a hospital emergency room in Seminole. From there, they were sent to a hospital in Tulsa, where, the following day, Ron was diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver. Inoperable, untreatable, no chance of a transplant. It was another death sentence, and a painful one at that. An optimistic forecast gave him 6 months. He had lived 51 years, and at least 14 of those had been behind bars with no opportunity to drink. Since his release 5 years earlier, he had certainly hit the bottle, but there had also been long periods of complete sobriety as he fought alcoholism. Cirrhosis seemed a little premature. Annette asked the tough questions, and the answers were not easy. In addition to all the booze, there was a history of illicit drug use, though very little since his release. A likely contributing cause was the history of medications. For at least half of his life, Ron had consumed, at various times and in varying amounts, potent doses of very strong psychotropic drugs. Perhaps he had a weak liver to begin with. It didn't matter now. Once again, Annette called Renee with news that was hard to believe. The doctors drained off several gallons of fluid, and the hospital asked Annette to find another place for him. She was turned down by 7 facilities before finding a room at the Broken Arrow Nursing Home. There, the nurses and staff welcomed Ronnie like an old member of the family. It was soon apparent to Annette and Renee that 6 months was an unrealistic prediction. Ron faded quickly. With the exception of his grossly swollen midsection, the rest of his body withered and shrank. He had no appetite and finally stopped smoking and drinking. As his liver rapidly shut down, the pain became excruciating. He was never comfortable and spent hours walking slowly around his room and up and down the hallways of the nursing home. The family circled the wagons and spent as much time with him as possible. Annette was nearby, but Renee and Gary and their children were living near Dallas. They made the 5-hour drive as often as possible. Mark Barrett visited his client several times. He was a busy lawyer, but Ron had always taken priority. They talked about death and life after it, about God and the promise of salvation through Christ. Ron was facing death with almost perfect contentment. It was something he looked forward to and had for many years. He had no fear of dying. He was not bitter. He regretted many of the things he'd done, the mistakes he'd made, the pain he'd caused. But he had sincerely asked God for forgiveness, and it had been granted. He carried no grudges, though Bill Peterson and Ricky Joe Simmons were strung along almost until the end. He eventually forgave them, too. The next visit, Mark brought up the subject of music, and Ron rambled for hours about his new career and how much fun he would have when he got out of the nursing home. The illness wasn't mentioned, nor was the part about dying. Annette delivered his guitar, but he found it difficult to play. Instead, he asked her to sing their favorite hymns. Ron's last performance was at the nursing home during a karaoke session. He somehow found the energy to sing. The nurses and many of the other patients by then knew his story and cheered him on. Afterward, with the recorded music playing in the background, he danced with both of his sisters. Unlike most dying patients with time to think and plan, Ron did not clamor for a minister to hold his hand and hear his final confessions and prayers. He knew the scriptures as well as any preacher. His foundation in the gospel was solid. Perhaps he'd strayed more than most, but he was sorry for that, and it was forgotten. He was ready. There had been a few bright moments in his 5 years of freedom, but it had generally been unpleasant. He had moved 17 times and had proven on several occasions that he could not live alone. What future did he have? He was a burden on Annette and Renee. He had been someone's burden for most of his life, and he was tired. Since death row, he had told Annette many times that he wished he'd never been born, and that he wanted desperately to just go ahead and die. He was ashamed of the misery he had caused, especially to their parents, and he wanted to go see them, to say he was sorry, to be with them forever. Soon after his release, she found him standing in her kitchen one day, trance-like, staring through a window. He grabbed her hand and said, "Pray with me, Annette. Pray that the Lord will just take me home, right now." It was a prayer she couldn't complete. When Greg Wilhoit arrived for the Thanksgiving holidays, he spent 10 straight days with Ronnie. Though Ron was rapidly slipping away and heavily sedated with morphine, they talked for hours about life on the row, horrible as always, but now the source of some belated humor. By November 2004, Oklahoma was executing condemned men at a record pace, and many of their old neighbors had finally been laid to rest. Ron knew a few would be in heaven when he got there. Most would not. He told Greg that he had seen the best of life and the worst. There was nothing else he cared to see, and he was ready to go. He was completely at peace with the Lord, Greg said. He had no fear of death. He just wanted to get it over with. When Greg said goodbye, Ron was barely conscious. The morphine was being used generously, and death was only days away. Ron's quick demise caught many of his friends off guard. Dennis Fritz passed through Tulsa but couldn't find the nursing home. He planned to return soon for a visit but didn't make it in time. Bruce Leba was working out of state and had temporarily lost contact. Almost at the last moment, Barry Scheck paid a visit, by phone. Dan Clark, an investigator who had worked on the civil case, rigged up a speakerphone, and Barry's voice filled the room. It was a one-way conversation. Ron was heavily medicated and almost dead. Barry promised to be there soon, to catch up on the gossip, and so on. He got a smile from Ron and a laugh from the others when he said, "And Ronnie, if you don't make it, I promise you we'll eventually get Ricky Joe Simmons." When the visiting was over, the family was called in. 3 years earlier, Taryn Simon, a noted photographer, traveled the country profiling exonerees for a book she planned to publish. She took pictures of Ron and Dennis and included a short summary of their case. Each was asked to write or say a few words to accompany his photograph. Ron said, "I hope I go to neither heaven nor hell. I wish that at the time of my death that I could go to sleep and never wake up and never have a bad dream. Eternal rest, like you've seen on some tombstones, that's what I hope for, because I don't want to go through the judgment. I don't want anybody judging me again. I asked myself what was the reason for my birth when I was on death row. If I was going to have to go through all that, what was even the reason for my birth? I almost cursed my mother and dad. It was so bad. For putting me on this earth. If I had it all to do over again, I wouldn't be born." From The Innocents, Umbridge, 2003. Faced with death, though, Ron retreated slightly. He very much wanted to spend eternity in heaven. On December 4th, Annette and Renee and their families gathered around his bed for the last time and said goodbye. 3 days later, a crowd assembled at the Hayhurst Funeral Home in Broken Arrow for the memorial service. Ron's pastor, the Reverend Ted Heaston, officiated the celebration of his life. Charles Story, Ron's chaplain from prison, spoke and recalled some warm anecdotes of their time together at McAllister. Mark Barrett delivered a moving eulogy about their special friendship. Cheryl Pilot read a letter sent in by Barry Scheck, who was occupied with not one, but two exonerations elsewhere. The casket was open. The pale, gray-haired old man was resting peacefully. His baseball jacket, glove, and bat were arranged on the casket, and beside it was his guitar. The music included two gospel classics, "I'll Fly Away" and "He Set Me Free," hymns Ron learned as a child and sang his entire life at revivals and church camps, at his mother's funeral with chains around his ankles, at death row during his darkest days, at Annette's the night he was set free. Toe-tapping music, the songs loosened up the crowd and made everyone smile. The service was sad, obviously, but there was a strong sense of relief. A tragic life was over, and the one who'd lived it had now gone on to better things. This was what Ronnie had prayed for. He was finally free. Later that afternoon, his mourners reassembled in Ada for the burial. A heartwarming number of the family's friends from the town gathered to honor his passing. Out of respect to the Carter family, Annette chose a different cemetery from the one where Debbie was buried. It was a cold and windy day, December 7th, 2004. Exactly 22 years since Debbie was last seen alive. The coffin was hauled into place by the pallbearers, a group that included Bruce Leba and Dennis Fritz. After a few final words from a local minister, a prayer, and some more tears, the last farewell was given. Permanently etched on his tombstone are the words, Ronald Keith Williamson, born February 3, 1953, died December 4, 2004. Strong survivor. Wrongly convicted in 1988. Exonerated April 15, 1999. Author's note. 2 days after Ron Williamson was buried, I was flipping through the New York Times when I saw his obituary. The headline, Ronald Williamson Freed from Death Row Dies at 51, was compelling enough, but the lengthy obituary, written by Jim Dwyer, had the clear makings of a much longer story. There was a striking photo of Ron standing in the courtroom the day he was exonerated, looking a bit perplexed and relieved, and perhaps even a little smug. Somehow, I had missed the story of his release in 1999, and I had never heard of Ron Williamson or Dennis Fritz. I read it a second time. Not in my most creative moment could I conjure up a story as rich and as layered as Ron's. And, as I would soon learn, the obituary barely scratched the surface. Within a few hours, I had talked to his sisters, Annette and Renee, and suddenly, I had a book on my hands. Writing nonfiction has seldom crossed my mind. I've had far too much fun with the novels, and I had no idea what I was getting into. The story and the research and writing of it consumed the next 18 months. It took me to Ada many times, to the courthouse and jail and coffee shops around town, to both the old death row and the new one at McAllister, to Asher, where I sat in the bleachers for 2 hours and talked baseball with Merle Bowen, to the offices of the Innocence Project in New York, to a cafe in Seminole, where I had lunch with Judge Frank C., to Yankee Stadium, to the prison in Lexington, where I spent time with Tommy Ward, and to Norman, my base, where I hung out with Mark Barrett and talked about the story for hours. I met Dennis Fritz in Kansas City, Annette and Renee in Tulsa, and when I could convince Greg Wilhoit to come home from California, we toured Big Mac, where he saw his old cell for the first time since he left it 15 years earlier. With every visit and every conversation, the story took a different twist. I could have written 5,000 pages. The journey also exposed me to the world of wrongful convictions, something that I, even as a former lawyer, had never spent much time thinking about. This is not a problem peculiar to Oklahoma, far from it. Wrongful convictions occur every month in every state in this country, and the reasons are all varied and all the same. Bad police work, junk science, faulty eyewitness identifications, bad defense lawyers, lazy prosecutors, arrogant prosecutors. In the cities, the workloads of criminologists are staggering and often give rise to less than professional procedures and conduct. And in the small towns, the police are often untrained and unchecked. Murders and rapes are still shocking events, and people want justice, and quickly. They, citizens and jurors, trust their authorities to behave properly. When they don't, the result is Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz, and Tommy Ward and Carl Fontenot. Both are now serving life terms. Tommy might one day be eligible for parole, but through a procedural quirk, Carl will never be. They cannot be saved by DNA because there is no biological evidence. The killer or killers of Denise Haraway will never be found, not by the police anyway. For more on their story, go to www.wardandfontenot.com. While researching this book, I came across two other matters, both relevant to Ada. In 1983, a man named Calvin Lee Scott was put on trial for rape in the Pontotoc County Courthouse. The victim was a young widow who was attacked in her bed as she slept, and because the rapist kept a pillow over her face, she could not identify him. A hair expert from the OSBI testified that two crime scene pubic hairs were microscopically consistent with samples taken from Calvin Lee Scott, who vehemently denied any guilt. The jury felt otherwise, and he was sentenced to 25 years in prison. He served 20 and was released. He was out of jail when DNA testing exonerated him in 2003. the case was investigated by Dennis Smith. Bill Peterson was the district attorney. Also, in 2001, Ada's former assistant chief of police, Dennis Corvin, pleaded guilty to federal charges of manufacturing and distributing methamphetamine and was sent away for 6 years. Corvin, as you might recall, was the Ada policeman mentioned by Glenn Gore in his affidavit signed some 20 years after their alleged drug-dealing ventures. Ada is a nice town, and the obvious question is, when will the good guys clean house? Perhaps when they get tired of paying for bad prosecutions. Twice in the past 2 years, the city of Ada has raised property taxes to replenish the reserve funds used to settle the lawsuits filed by Ron and Dennis. In a cruel insult, these taxes are paid by all property owners, including many members of Debbie Carter's family. It is impossible to calculate the total amount of money wasted. Oklahoma spends about $20,000 a year to house an inmate. Ignoring the extra cost of death row and treatment in state mental hospitals, Ron's tab was at least $250,000. Same for Dennis. Add the amounts they received in the civil suit, and the math becomes easy. It's safe to say that several $1 million were wasted because of their cases. These sums do not begin to contemplate the thousands of hours spent by the appellate lawyers who worked so diligently to free the men, nor do they include the time wasted by the state's lawyers trying to execute them. Every dollar spent prosecuting and defending them was mailed in by the taxpayers. But there were some savings. Barney Ward was paid a whopping $3,600 to defend Ron, and, as you remember, Judge Jones denied Barney's request for money to hire a forensic expert to evaluate the state's evidence. Greg Saunders received the same fee, $3,600. He, too, was denied access to an expert. The taxpayers had to be protected. The financial waste was frustrating enough, but the human toll was far more damaging. Obviously, Ron's mental problems were greatly exacerbated by the wrongful conviction, and, once freed, he never recovered. Most exonerees do not. Dennis Fritz is a lucky one. He had the courage and the intelligence and, eventually, the money to put his life back together. He lives a quiet, normal, and prosperous life in Kansas City, and last year became a grandfather. Of the other characters, Bill Peterson is still the district attorney in Ada. Two of his assistants are Nancy Hsu and Chris Ross. One of his investigators is Gary Rogers. Dennis Smith retired from the Ada Police Department in 1987 and died suddenly on June 30, 2006. Barney Ward died in the summer of 2005 as I was writing the book, and I never had the chance to interview him. Judge Ron Jones was voted out of office in 1990 and left the Ada area. Glenn Gore is still housed on H Unit at McAllister. In July 2005, his conviction was overturned by the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, and a new trial was ordered. The court decided that Gore did not receive a fair trial because Judge Landreth did not allow his defense lawyer to put on proof that two other men had already been convicted of the murder. On June 21, 2006, Gore was again found guilty. The jury deadlocked on the issue of death, and Judge Landreth, as required by law, sentenced Gore to life without parole. I owe much to many people who helped with this book. Annette and Renee and their families gave me complete access to every aspect of Ron's life. Mark Barrett spent countless hours driving me around Oklahoma, telling me stories that I at first found hard to believe, and locating witnesses, pulling out old files, and leaning on his network of contacts. His assistant, Melissa Harris, copied a million documents and kept everything in meticulous order. Dennis Fritz revisited his painful history with remarkable enthusiasm and answered all my questions. Greg Wilhoit did the same. Brenda Tollett, with the Ada Evening News, dug through the archives and magically produced copies of the paper's extensive history of the two murders. Ann Kelly Weaver, now with the Oklahoman, was quick to recall many of the stories surrounding the exoneration. At first, Judge Frank C. was reluctant to talk about one of his cases. He still holds to the old-fashioned notion that judges should be heard and not seen, but he eventually came around. In one of our phone conversations, I suggested that he was a hero, a description he quickly objected to. I was overruled from 1,200 miles away. Vicki Hildebrand still works for him and vividly remembers her first reading of Ron's petition for habeas corpus relief. Jim Payne is now a federal judge himself and, though cooperative, showed little interest in taking credit for saving Ron's life. But he is a hero. His careful reading of Janet Chesley's brief at home after hours prompted concern enough to approach Judge C. and recommend an 11th-hour stay of execution. Though he entered the story in a late chapter, Judge Tom Landreth had the unique pleasure of presiding over the exoneration hearing in April 1999. Visiting his office in the Ada Courthouse was always a treat. The stories, many of them probably true, flowed forth with great ease. Barry Scheck and the warriors at the Innocence Project were gracious and open. As of this writing, they have freed 180 prisoners by DNA testing, and they have inspired at least 30 other Innocence Projects around the country. For a closer look, go to www.innocenceproject.org. Tommy Ward spent 3 years and 9 months on death row on the old F cell house before being permanently exiled to the prison in Lexington. We swapped many letters. Some of his stories were about Ron, and he allowed me to use them in these pages. Regarding his nightmare, I relied heavily on The Dreams of Ada by Robert Mayer. It's a fascinating book, a wonderful reminder of how good true crime writing can be. Mr. Mayer was thoroughly cooperative during my research. Thanks to the lawyers and staff at the Oklahoma Indigent Defense System, Janet Chesley, Bill Luker, and Kim Marks, and to Bruce Leba, Merle Bowen, Christy Shepherd, Leslie Delk, Dr. Keith Hume, Nancy Vollertson, Dr. Susan Sharp, Michael Salem, Gail Seward, Lee Mann, David Morris, and Bert Colley. John Sherman, a third-year law student at the University of Virginia, spent a year and a half buried in the boxes of research we collected, and somehow kept it all straight. I had the benefit of volumes of sworn testimony from most of those involved in this story. Some interviews were not needed. Some were not granted. Only the names of the alleged rape victims have been changed. John Grisham, July 1st, 2006. This is Craig Wasson. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Innocent Man, Murder and Injustice in a Small Town by John Grisham. This program was produced and directed by Bob Walter. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2006 by Bennington Press, LLC. Production copyright 2006, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.